Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. Well, to the End of the Line with me is the deer slayer, wait, duck slayer himself, Double R2. Ramsey Russell, hey, you put down the shotgun and picked up the rifle.
Yeah, I did. I sure did, Rocky. We hunted the Arkansas Oprah for a few days. We went down hunting with Dale Bordlin and jumped over here to Mississippi the Friday after Thanksgiving. I got to admit, our team had a pretty decent opener. There were six of us in the blind. We all like to hunt together, and we had a beatdown. It was good, and that wasn't no pretty ducks. It was a lot of blackjacks and a few gadwalls, a few mallards. Heck, I was telling you earlier, I shot more deer one afternoon than I shot mallards the whole opening week. And that was something else. And you know, by the time second split came away last Friday, I came over here to camp, decided I was gonna hunt Friday morning. I stepped outside and it was drizzle, nearly 70 degrees. I walked back inside and watched the news, started packing for Alaska. And they had a pretty good weekend last weekend.
Before you leave that, you know one thing that you said to me last Friday that I think that all people should know, because it's a rule that I followed for many years. And I don't know if it's so much a rule, but it's just a hunter's intuition. If you have moisture buildup on your concrete, it's probably not a good day to go hunting, duck hunting.
No, I'm gonna tell you, I call it, man. Look, if I walk out in my garage, the concrete is condensated, I probably ain't. I might go hunting, but I'm gonna go kicking and dragging. I ain't gonna feel good about it. I don't think the ducks fly in that kind of weather. And last weekend could have been described as an exception to that rule because in all honesty, it was easy for me not to go hunting because it was yucky, nasty, wet, warm weather. And it was just a very easy excuse. The truth of the matter is I really needed it because right now, man, Rocky, I had like 5 web pages to build, and I'd been putting it off and been putting it off. And man, I'm at a point right now. I'm going to tell you, between now and the next 2 or 3 months, I feel like Stretch Armstrong. I'm so tight, son. I mean, it's a tight schedule right now. You know, it's like, when is this going to get done? And it just, boy, when I walked out Friday and it was just that, it just didn't feel right. And I'm like, I'm not going. And that morning I sat right here, watched 5 o'clock news, and I heard a few shots and went down mid morning to go tidy up and get some stuff out of my Ranger. And looked at the sign out board, and they shot 2s and 3s. I'm like, yeah, I did the right thing. I'm going home, and I'm going to knock this stuff out. Man, I got my 2019 convention catalog put to bed. I got my web pages built. My wife and I we've got a ship for convention the week of December 15th, and we are 90% packed for it. It was just, and it had to be because, man, I'm telling you what, tomorrow I've got some work to do, finish packing for convention, and pack. And then I'm gone until Christmas. And when I get back for Christmas, guess what? I'm coming over here. We're selling hunts, man, but all my cell phone rings, and I get emails, and that's anywhere in the world. I'm at the office for that. But beyond that, you know, I am coming over here Christmas and New Year. Jake LaTondres is coming down. I've got Blood Origins coming over later in the month. Sitka's supposed to come down and film a piece. We got things to do. And then right in the middle of January, I leave on like the 7th of January, go out to Reno, and on that Saturday, we box up and crate everything, sleep with the Angel because we're so exhausted after standing on your feet for 4 hours in Reno, and fly to Dallas so we can set up for convention the very next week. And that's going to be, and I'll get back to Mississippi with 7, 8 days to go for the Mississippi season, and I'll be able to relax a little bit then. I'll be able to relax, but until then, man, it was so easy to shirk off going hunting. And the truth of the matter is, we were talking about this not too long ago on the Duck South site. Somebody said, when's a good time to go or something. And my old buddy, Josh Criswell, said it best. He says, just go. It don't matter what the weather's doing, east, west, north, south, hot, cold, just go. You never know what's going to happen. I said the same thing. The best time to go is just go. If you don't kill but one duck, what if it's banded? What if it's something special? What if? You know, just go. Life short, get ducks. Oh, no, boy. I've been home doing responsible stuff. You know, real adult stuff. And, man, some boys I hunt with over here, one of the teams I hunt with over here, they go out, they get the high card, they go shoot mallards and gadwalls and a few wood ducks and teal. Just wow, you know. And look, we just went to a poker chip system. And I told them the other day, I said, y'all have another weekend like that in 70-degree weather, we're going to go back to them cards because they couldn't draw nothing for cards. You hear me? They couldn't draw nothing. Well, they came over here and racked up with the new draw system, and they got the high card, and they went and shot a bunch of birds. The next day, somebody they were hunting with drew it, and they went back and shot a freaking leucistic gadwall. Beautiful bird. Well, that afternoon in between those two hunts, they draw high, go to a deer stand, and the daddy shoots a 20-inch whitetail. I'm going to tell you, I told him, I said, you know, Ben, if I was you, I hate to say it, that's a whole lot of luck to have wasted on a bunch of ducks and deer. You should have gone and bought a Powerball ticket. You know, you really would have hit something then. But they did, and here I was at the office getting all these text messages, thinking, well, dadgum, of all the 70-something degree weekends to skip, I skipped the wrong one. But it is what it is. But I as a rule, I have very little expectations. Whatever it is between the temperature and the humidity is such that my concrete condensates. That just is that's a thrill kill to me. And typically, nothing really moves in that kind of weather. But,
especially,
you know,
the
over the weekend, that fog, you know. Yeah, I mean, ducks can't see you. You got to be just, it's a mess. I mean, yeah.
Ramsey, I don't think that people, and I'm going to go total reverse back to, I wasn't going to stop you as you were going, but I don't think that people understand how much you put into this business as far as day-to-day activities, not just hunting.
Oh, no. Man. No,
and you
hunting
are a self-taught, not only marketer, but programmer, putting this stuff together.
I do all the writing and all the artwork. Yeah, guys like Jake LaTondres will do the, I've hired guys like him. And I'd say if you look at my webpage, because now I've got to convert a lot of the artwork at Get Ducks to some of Jake's pictures and some of these other photographers' pictures, which just takes so much time. But so many of the photographs on there are photos I took, because I did start taking pictures back in the day, you know, and I was that guy. I never forget one time, Rocky, I was up in the mountains camp with a bunch of kids from all over the country. It was what was the name of that program? It was some kind of program you go and backpack in the mountains for 23 days. My grandmother sent me on that thing. And it was really was a very life-changing event. But I never forget listening to these kids from California talk about this newfangled computer stuff. I mean, it was a fad. Come on, man. This was 1989. They're talking about doing stuff on computers. That's a fad, man. Get real. That's what I said. Whew, boy, was I wrong. Huh? And you know, but as a photographer, I shot 64 Kodachrome. You didn't know what you had. I'm talking for decades. I got a job one time working at an old photography store in Jackson, and I processed film for people. And I just got a little understanding of photography and got me a camera and started taking pictures. And I thought this digital stuff was a mess, man. I'm like, man, I mean, it really is. You know, golly, you didn't know what you had. When you went out and you took your grayscale settings and you bracket shot and you did all this kind of stuff and did the best you could to compose a picture, you know, you really didn't know what you had till you sent that 64 Kodachrome off and you got that slide film back weeks later.
Hey, can I pick the story that we tell tonight?
Yeah.
I think we got enough time to tell it. Please, please tell the Russian tale.
I knew I shouldn't have told you that story. I knew it was going to come back and haunt me.
Story ever.
All right, I'm going to tell this story. And then there's so many stories like this. Because, you know, I don't know how much time we just burned talking about writing and different stuff like that. But
let me prepare you just listen to this. You're about to hear one of the greatest unique stories, adventures to another country ever.
Everybody thinks they want to do what I do. And don't get me wrong, everybody wants to duck hunt. I get that. But they really don't understand really what goes on into this thing we do. And, for example, one time I've got this really good client that's become a really good friend. I mean a really good friend, like a brother-type friend, really good friend of mine. And he's really kind of part of our A-team. I would say we have a list of 30 or 40 clients. A-team, kind of the only way I could describe them. I'm going to some absolutely far-flung place, have absolutely no idea what I'm getting into, really. And, you know, I can call them up and say, hey, I'm going to this place. There could be these species. I can't answer 90% of the questions I can normally answer because it's purely exploratory. And that's the word. That's what these guys are into. They're into the exploratory part. And so, for example, my friend from Montana, been to Argentina a lot of times. He's been to Mexico a lot of times. He's done a lot of stuff with us. He's an accomplished hunter in his own right. And one day he called me up and says, man, I had a great time down here. Like, da-da-da-da-da. And he said, but, you know, I'm ready to do some real Ramsey shit. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, man, you know, explore. I want to do this stuff. Uncharted, just a unknown. I just want to roll and just do that real stuff. I said, Scott, everybody wants to do Ramsey stuff. Everybody wants to do that until it's time to do real Ramsey stuff. He said, oh, yeah, I get that. So what I told you, Rocky, was a story that's just, to me, a kind of a funny example of real Ramsey stuff. Stuff you don't see typed on the on the travel brochure, you know, but the kind of stuff you just, you know, you look back at sometimes. And so years ago, and you got to understand now, we were a young company. We were virtually a nobody. I've told that story before. The economy was bad. We pushed in the chips. We bet the house. It worked. The economy came back. Boom. We were in position. We were somewhere we could climb, but still at this time, We were virtual nobody. We were selling Argentina. We were selling some Mexico. We were selling some Canada. U.S. Hunt List didn't exist at the time. And, you know, when I've got places I want to go and do, I knew I wanted to get, I knew that the status quo, Argentina and Mexico and Europe, that just wasn't my exact calling. I wanted to be off the beaten path. I wanted to be Christopher Columbus. I wanted to explore new areas and see new things. And I wanted to scale this thing out worldwide. I wanted to go to so many new and unique places nobody had ever thought about going. That was my calling. This was how I was going to do it. And so I really had a pretty hectic schedule for back then. I was going to, you know, especially financially, I was going to go here for a little bit. I was going to go there for a little bit. One day the phone rings. It's a real thick Russian accent. And he invites me to come to Russia, and he starts describing it. We go back and forth. We swap emails a few times, and I'm like, yeah, I'm interested. He says, good, you can come right now. And I'm like, oh, no, I can't come then. I mean, are you kidding? That's like 3 weeks from now. I can't do that. And because I mean, money and time, I mean, golly, you know, like to go to Russia, like a lot of countries, some countries you just need a passport. Some countries you need a visa. And going to Russia is very involved. You have to physically send your passport off and send it to consulates offices and all kinds of crazy stuff. And it's a time consuming and involved process of getting visas in some of these countries. Oh, but I wanted to go. Don't get me wrong. I wanted to go. And we just studied the calendar and did everything. And if everything fell into place just right, and the visa help company did everything just right, and everything fell into place, it would work. Well, it kind of sort of did. I tell you, long story short, I missed the first flight that I was scheduled to go. We had to reschedule the flight, and I ended up a day late. But it's like literally at 8 o'clock one morning came a knock on the door. It was FedEx. They handed me my passport. I thanked them, reached down by the door and picked up my suitcase, followed him out the front door, down the driveway, got in my car where my wife was waiting, and drove to the airport. Kissed her on the cheek, and I was gone for 2 weeks to Russia. And it was an amazing adventure. It was everything I wanted it to be. It was, there were ducks, tufted ducks, Eurasian widgeons, of course, mallards and golden eyes and a lot of cool stuff. But it was, we flew into St. Petersburg. I was late. The plan was for me to join a team of Maltons. What is a Malton? Well, Malta is a little island, 24 by 7 miles, 7 miles across, 24 miles long, in the middle of the Mediterranean Ocean. Okay, I'm going to join these Malton hunters, and we're going to go. And the great thing about joining them, my outfitter explained, was I'd get to see a lot more country and a lot more camps and experience a lot more opportunities. And if I was going to come this far to begin organizing his hunt, that would be better, wouldn't it? Sure. I'll spend 2 weeks over in Russia. And I fell in with these Maltons, and they were real hunters, and they spoke good English. They speak all kinds of, and let me give you a geography lesson, because it's a very interesting thing, this Malta deal. You know, who would have dreamed that in the middle of the Mediterranean Ocean exists this little island that's been owned and conquered by everybody surrounding them, from Greece to Rome to Italy, all these countries. They speak like a mulatto language. The oldest dwelling, the oldest human dwelling on Earth is right there on Malta. It was a major stopover port and all this kind of stuff back historically in those days. And even though the European Union, of which they are a part, prohibits bird collecting, those guys are zealous bird collectors. That is the national thing, bird collecting. And you catch a lot of birds that migrate and see this little island out in the middle of nowhere as they're migrating across the Mediterranean Ocean. And they don't just collect waterfowl. They collect birds. One of the men I met had over 800 species in his collection. Both of them were in some form of construction as their main jobs, but went and did little hobby jobs in people's basements building out bird collecting studios. And we became good friends. They were very interesting people. Rocky, we would see a Tweety bird a sparrow-looking bird, some bird, some, any bird, some, and every one of those Maltons knew the common name and the scientific name at a glance. Shorebird, boom, they knew it. Raptors, boom, they knew it. Sparrows, boom, they knew it. They were such excellent people. Like one day we'd been duck hunting. They'd been somewhere off. I could hear them shooting some, and me and another guy had been over here shooting. And I had waded off into a creek, snow-trimmed, you know, ice-rimmed creek. Shot some mallards that day, shot some other ducks, shot a smew, which is one of the species I was after. I was soaking wet. My hip boots had leaked. It was cold. I was tired. It had started to grow dark. I walked back to the truck and was ready to go. And they said, "Oh no, we're gonna go woodcock hunting." I go, "Woodcock? What? Huh? Yeah, we're gonna go woodcock hunting." And I'm like, "Oh, are there any woodcock around here?" They go, "Oh, this is perfect woodcock habitat." And I asked the Russian guy, "I go, are there any woodcock around here?" He just shrugged. He didn't know. I go, "What makes y'all think this is good woodcock hunting?" They go, "Well, this habitat over here is such, and this over here is great. So what we're going to do is line up down this road, and at dark, the woodcock will fly over." Well, the truck wasn't going, so I might as well go sit in the road cold. And sure enough, man, it right there at twilight, here come the woodcock flying through. I shot two big European woodcock. Most, they're twice the size of a North American woodcock.
And good eating.
And good eating. It was unbelievable. These guys knew this. And one day, for example, I did not go out in the rain and hunt because they all had bird collars, electronic bird collars, and they were going to shoot shore birds like curlews and plovers and them little long-billed doohickey birds coming off the river. And we'd been transported to the field in like this little mini truck of sorts, not a Chevrolet truck, but you know, like one of these little mini Russian trucks. It had a camper on back, a homemade camper on back, and a little bitty, man, it's like riding buckboards. I mean, your head, you hit a bump, and sometimes you jump a foot off the bench. And so I sat in there because they had this little bitty stove in there, about the size of a coffee can, but you put the wood in there and load it up. Man, it warmed that thing up, and I sat there and sipped my coffee. I'd made myself a thermos of coffee, and I didn't see any point going out and shooting birds that I didn't know what they were, and I know I couldn't import, do anything with. That's just not my cup of tea. But I'd wipe the humidity off the window and watch them shoot. And it was amazing because, you know, it's like you'd see I never forget seeing a curlew come off the river, and it locked its wings. And it never flapped. It just glided for about a half mile right into where that guy was calling him. Boom, he shot one time. It fell. He was very proud. He skinned him out, took him back to Malta to get mounted. Somebody shot a golden plover that was banded in Belgium. That was kind of cool. That golden plover looks like a little, just think of a little piping plover, what's some little birds that run around in Mississippi? A killdeer. Think of a little killdeer-sized bird. It looked like somebody had dropped melted gold onto it. It was unbelievably beautiful. But that was kind of their thing. So for the first week we hunted there, well, that particular afternoon, I'd been with this guide, this Russian guide, that for 3 days had not uttered a word of English. When we sank some mallards off in that frozen creek that day, man, we didn't know how we were going to get them. You know, he showed up. Stripped down butt naked, dove off into the creek, scooped him up, threw him across on the other side of the bank, climbed out of the ice, jumped up and down and rubbed himself, threw him back over to our side of the creek, jumped in the water and came up. And I was like, man, this guy's Superman. I mean, dove into water with ice flowing down this creek and did this for us. Hey, what a great guy. And so if we were just sitting there, he was sitting in there warming up, you know, the guy, the client, the Maltons were out shooting these doohickey birds. And I was just looking at my phone, you know, pictures on my phone. And this was a real life lesson for me because I realized we didn't speak the same language, but I've said it in other podcasts, music. Everybody knows Metallica and Iron Maiden and AC/DC and Guns N' Roses. And pictures. Look, everybody, they may not understand the word for wife and kids or home, but it's universal. They see the picture, they get it. So I started showing him pictures. And about midway through this photo stream, he goes, "Your wife?" I go, "You speak English?" And he says, "Just a very little." Well, that was it. It broke the ice. So as the Maltons came in from hunting, we all piled up in the van and we talked a little bit. I said, "Hey, that guy speaks some English." I go, "Oh, yeah, you know." And so we drove a little while, and about this time, and you gotta understand, this is rural, remote Russia, poor Russia. And all the houses are built out of just plain, milled, unpainted, unstained, un-anything wood, like cypress, like old cabins. And old cinder block buildings, no road improvement, nothing like that, just old remote Russia, simple people. And we stopped, and I heard some rushing. I kind of looked out the window, and there was this big, huge, black Mercedes sedan, and this guy steps out, and man, he's wearing like this three-piece suit and this overcoat, obviously very expensive, very prominent person. They start talking. The back door to the van opens up. And me look at this guy, looks like a mobster, okay? We start jumping out, and the guide, Mikhail was his name, he starts motioning the Maltons to climb into this Mercedes. And they do, and as it's my turn, I'm last in line, as I start to round the truck, he puts his hand, he says, "Do you want to go to camp, or do you want to go to the river?" And I said, "Well, I've seen camp, but I hadn't seen the river, so this guy invited me to go. I'll go with him." And so off goes the Mercedes. I get the front seat of this truck. We drive to this old apartment building, and it's just cinder block, raw cinder block. The back porches, the balconies, you know, off these apartments have like clotheslines, and they're just, you know, old lady bloomers and long johns and work shirts and fish drying and just all these different things. I'm in Russia, man. This is like just imagine old communist Russia. This is it. We this old door creaks into a stairwell. We go into this dank stairwell, and there's a little moisture, and you can kind of hear your feet smashing water as you're going. And we go up these steel stairs, and he takes out a key and he opens the apartment door, and their door jams have like a steel facing all the way around it. Well, I didn't realize that. So I stumped my toe on 2 inches of steel stepping into his apartment. As I walk in, it's nice and warm and inviting. And two young ladies get off a couch. And I learned later that the reason he speaks English is his wife is in English translation school. She's got some old college friends in. Those are them. And he brought me to his apartment because now there's three people that speak English, so he and I can really talk. So we sit down. Man, they're breaking food out of the refrigerator to his grandmother's jam and these pickles somebody made and all this kind of fish. Oh, here's a very Russian dish you should try. And we sit around for 2 hours just eating and talking. And, man, the translator girls, they're just eating it up because they got somebody that, you know, that can teach them words and talk to them. We have this great time. And then his friend comes over with this old Russian Jeep, and we get in it, say goodbye to the girls, and we go off into this up this hill, and we go to this place. It's a, man, this raging river of like aquamarine colored clear type water just roaring down this gorge, and it's a dam, and we park, and like the dam had a bridge over, and upstream of the bridge is like 10 acres of log jam. And they're like, "Be very careful, it could break with all this weight coming against it." I'm like, "What am I going to do if it does?" You know? And so we go across it, and we launch the boat. We just start running up the river. And off this river, you'll pull off, and there's like these little quiet spots surrounded by woods. And man, when we come off, they cut the motor. Then we just coast up in there. You're holding your breath quietly, 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 just waiting on a duck to jump up. Well, there were no ducks. It was just too early. It was just too cold. The birds were still south of us. We're like literally 50 kilometers from the Arctic Circle, okay? And, you know, so there's no ducks. So we stop on this island, and they start cutting open their little knapsack of food, coffee, and hot tea, and make a fire to make them hot water, to make them hot tea, and they've got this bread. And they eat this thing called sallow. Sallow is kind of like pork, smoked pork fat. Sounds terrible. It's delicious.
And sounds awful.
It sounds awful, but it's delicious. I'll eat a pound of it. And it's just, and we eat just different cut meats and cheeses and breads and just talk what little we can. And, you know, the universal language among hunters. We can't perfectly communicate, but we communicate. And the day got away from us, you know. And man, I'm taking pictures and I'm asking questions. And you know, when you go somewhere, especially to another country, and I had this talk. I met a two-star general not too long ago down in Louisiana. And we were talking, and I said, you know, one thing I've noticed in all my world travels is Russians and Mexicans and Argentines and Romanians and Swedes and all these different nationalities, they have got such profound national pride. It's like, you know, to hear it on the news on Good Morning America and CNN and all, you know, you think most Americans, I'm very proud to be an American. I see what advantages we have in life. But, you know, seems to me that of all the countries in the world, the country that should be the proudest generally is most apologetic about its standing in the world. But not Russians, man. They're very proud. And people in general. And what I've seen is as I travel with a camera, even if it's just my phone now, and you take pictures and you ask questions about their wives and their lives and their families and their culture and their country, they just, this wall comes down. They open it up and they bring you inside and they introduce you to their families and they say, I'm going to take you to the river and I'm going to show you Russia. And so when we come down off the river, we hook the boat back up. We go across the old rickety bridge and hope it doesn't break. And we stop. There's this big brick building. I say big. It's, you know, 50 by 50 brick building. And inside it, he talks Russian to the guy, the security guard at the gate. We walk in, and just right there in the middle of this building is this massive turbine, because it was a hydroelectric dam, and that turbine was collecting power. And he told me at one time this turbine generated all the power of northern Karelia, the province we were in. And he said, now, let me show you this. And we walked out, and up on the outside of the brick were like these holes and pock marks, you know, on the side of the brick. And he says, that's artillery and bullet holes. Because during the Bolshevik Revolution, this was a very, very big battle site, because he who owns the power owns the people. When you live somewhere, it gets to minus 40. Whoever holds, you're going to kiss the ring of whoever holds the power and keeps your heat on. So it was a big battle site. I don't remember what we did after that. We walked around, we looked, we just explored this country. We didn't. I never pulled the trigger on my gun. I don't. After the duck hunt, I don't think I even loaded it. But so that night, it got dark, and we finally made it back to camp. And as we came in, it was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning. It had been dark a couple of hours, and as we walked in, the host, he hugged me. He pulls that guy aside and starts scolding him. I sit down at the table with the Maltons, and they're like, oh my gosh, where have you been? You've been gone for 12 hours. Where have you been? And I took my drink. I said, you know, what'd y'all do today? And he said, oh, we hunted. We didn't shoot anything. We tried to shoot a capercaillie or do something. So I said, yeah, well, I just saw real Russia. Rocky, this part of the story, I'd say I thought I had seen real Russia, but as you know, the story continues. So the next morning we got up, and we packed, and we went to another camp. And we went way up north, and we were right on the banks of the White Sea. And we were literally, I have actually been there. The one of the stores we went to one day after a capercaillie hunt, we stopped at this little old store, and I realized, because we passed a sign that said it, Arctic Circle. I mean, we were literally 20 kilometers, roughly 12 miles from the Arctic Circle now. It's early May. And when I first committed to doing this trip, they had asked me if I wanted to shoot capercaillie. I said, yeah, what is it? I didn't know. I'd never heard of a capercaillie. I want to shoot ducks. And we shot ducks. This was the trip. I mean, you know, right about the time I think I've seen and done it all in the world of duck hunting, I go eider hunting on the White Sea in Russia. There's no decoys. There's a Russian that smiles. He's very proud that he's got a very fast boat. It doesn't look like much of a boat. It's like just a single hull aluminum, a little 1950 ski boat or something, an outboard, and man, it'll scat. It'll go. And you know, I had my camera out gonna take pictures. No, that didn't work, man. We're hitting those waves across that sea just full force, you know, and I finally had to put my camera up and just hang on for dear life. And when I realized how they hunted the eiders, it's like I'm in the back seat of the boat. I'm holding on with my left hand to the side of the boat. I've got my left foot on that gun wall and my right foot on this gun wall, and hoping that by anchoring myself, my left hand and my feet, that when we hit one of them waves, I don't go flying out of the back of the boat, never to be seen again. And I'm holding my shotgun with my right hand, shoulder, so I'm shooting one hand, and it's like we're hitting a wave and we're airborne, and we pass by the eider who's flying about as fast as we are, and boom, I missed the first three shots. Four shot, I hit one. And I never forget, the eider dove under, and I could see him. He's just right there swimming. And I reached down. The Russian reached over and pulled my hand out, and he says something in Russian like, you know, you fool, that's stupid. What are you doing? I'm like, be right there. The water was so clear. It looked like he was just feet under the water. Man, he was 10 feet under the water. The water was so clear. And so he turned the nose of the boat. Finally, when that eider popped up, he knew just what that eider was going to do. That eider was going to swim with that undercurrent. He let the boat just drift. When the eider popped up, boom, he's right there. Boom, I shot him. He cranked up the boat. He patted me on the back, cranked up the boat and floored it. And here we go again to hunt another eider. That's how we eider hunted. Well, getting back to the capercaillie story, capercaillie is the world's largest grouse. And they make a fan display like a strut on a turkey. They're about 8 pounds. They're a very beautiful bird. A lot of y'all that follow us on social media probably saw this Russian trip we did this year. It's a very incredible hunt. People ask how you hunt them. And if you see a true European capercaillie gun, it's usually a very nice over and under with a Monte Carlo cheek piece. And one barrel is going to be chambered for like 223 or something like that. And the other barrel is going to be a 12 gauge or a 20 gauge. And they hunt the birds. There's a pretty long hunting season. And a lot of the winter season, a lot of the times they hunt these birds, they rifle them. Because it'd be like going out in the fall to shoot a turkey. You can't sneak on them, except they're so close. You can't call them in because they're not in their calling season. So they rifle them out of trees or whatever like that. Well, in the calling season, during their breeding season, grouse have the habit of being on a lek, okay, a breeding lek. And it's like their little breeding area, and all the males in this territory will gather on this lek and begin to compete for dominance, and they'll sing, and they'll call in the females. Like everybody knows the rough grouse up north, you hear them drumming, drumming on the tree log or drumming their wings. It sounds like an Indian beating the drums. That's what calls all the hens in. Well, these capercaillie have a two-part song. The first part sounds like somebody clicking their tongues. Four notes, click, 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 click. And then it sounds like a gurgle. So they're up in a tree in the spring, and they begin their song right when the sun starts to come up. Now look, guys, we're right up by the Arctic Circle. When I say sunrise, it takes 4 hours from the time your imagination tells you it might be getting lighter until the sun pops up. It takes 3 or 4 hours. Time moves very slow, and it's only daylight for a little bit of time, like 6 hours, 5 hours. But it takes a long time for that sun to rise. And that's when they're active, is during sunrise. Once the sun is up, they shut up. They get down. They feed. They do whatever grouse do when they're not calling the females. But the interesting thing about this is they get up in this tree. And after that fourth click, after that note, a gland in their ear swells and they become deaf. So he's up in a tree, he's got his eyes closed, a gland in his ear swells. You got just enough time, because there is no walking quietly in Capercaillie Woods. It's sticks and moss and leaves and pine needles and snow and water and mud, and there's no moving like smoke through Capercaillie Woods. But in that instant, you can take two steps, step, step, or because you're in the snow, crunch, crunch. And at the end of them two steps, you don't blink, you don't move. When you take that second step, you put your foot down good. Don't worry about cracking that limb underneath it. You got to be planted, because when he opens his eyes, he's looking for hens, and if he sees you, he's gone. He ain't gonna see you just sitting there being still looking at the ground. If you're lucky, and I've done this enough times now, if you're lucky, he's really singing click, 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 gurr, 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 gurr. He took crunch, 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 crunch. You can advance on him, but sometimes you're sitting there standing for 20 minutes just waiting on him to do something. It's like chess. You wait on him to make a move, and it's very so. First time I go out with Roger, oh my gosh, what a story! Alexis says, "Oh, you go out with him. We go Capercaillie hunting." I go, "Okay, yeah." So Roger comes by at 10:30. It gets dark at 11:30. We walk 2 miles. I'm pacing like an old forester, you know. 13 paces a chain, so many paces a mile. I figure I'm 2 miles down a bear trail in the middle of a black forest environment. It gets pitch black dark. My feet go completely numb. I'm cold. It's so cold, I think I can hear my breath freezing, because it's so quiet in those woods when you're not moving. And all of a sudden, Roger jumps and he hears something. He punches me. I don't hear nothing. I think I might hear something. Well, there's two of us hunters. So we kind of start moving towards the direction of all these songs. All this calling going on. And then the man speaks no English. Thumbs up, thumbs down. That's it. He indicates to me, stay. Sit here. He takes another hunter off. They go that way. And I'm sitting here and there's snow everywhere, little aspen breaking. All of a sudden, I see these birds walking around. And I'm like, well, there's a Capercaillie. That's a grouse. And I could tell the roosters, because they got their fans up. I'm like, oh my, this ain't nothing. You know, all this lecture and all this how to hunt. This, I'm sitting here. I saw 30 Capercaillie standing there. One of them flies up in a tree. I'm saying, well, golly, this is so easy. Boom! I shoot, he flies off. Well, when I walk out to the tree, I'm thinking grouse, like a spruce grouse or a blue grouse or a, no. Again, these things are big as a turkey, big as a hen turkey. I was thinking grouse, so it was 60 yards. I missed him, and that's kind of the end of that hunt. And we're walking out. As we were walked in, I noticed we had gone through these two swamp areas. As we're walking out, we're following Roger, and he's using a GPS to mark his way out the trail. We're not taking the bear trail this time. We're just kind of rawhiding it through the country. And he says, all of a sudden I noticed we come up on this third swampy area. It's a little muskeg. And I counted two coming through. Now we're on a third one. He's following his GPS. I found it kind of odd. And I took a step and sunk off about waist deep in snow. I heard some commotion, and now the muskeg comes to geese, and I have two gray lag geese. And he says something in Russian that I took to mean shoot them, which is exactly what he said. So I can't do anything but throw two shells in my gun. When the geese fly over, treetop high, short tree, boom, boom, shoot them. Well, now I'm stuck carrying them. Why, he's following the GPS, big deal. Oh, yeah. After we get across that muskeg, he stops, and I see him looking at it and punching buttons and scratching his head, the universal symbol for what the heck. So I walk over and look over his shoulder, and I realize he had toggled that GPS and just was looking at the cursor on the GPS, not on his own beacon. So I reached over and pushed a button, and it put us on the beacon, and he said something that I just interpreted as F-bomb. So I turned the GPS off, put it in his pocket, took a right, started walking towards the sound of the river we'd heard all morning. He's lost. and we're in the middle of who knows where, Russia. So we get to this big, massive river like the one I seen at the other camp. There's swans floating down it. There's ice. There's freaking, we shot a pair of goldeneye. It flew out of nowhere. He picks out a cell phone and calls somebody. I pull out my cell phone and look. I've got 5 bars. I call my wife. She's asleep, but I called her. And around the curve comes this little one-man rubber boat with a guy paddling oars. And we walk down to him, and they talk in Russian, and he indicates for the guy I'm with to get in the boat, and he goes across the river. When the boat comes back, well, probably my turn. Nope, I wait. He gets in the boat, they go across the river. When the boat comes back, I figure, well, now it's my turn. I'm going to go across the river. Nope, I get in the boat, I almost turn it over, and we go back the way the man came. And so we paddle and we paddle and we paddle, you know. And there's all this brush around this river, and I can smell smoke. And we get right up to the edge of this bank, and about this time, these 2 hands come out of the bushes and grab the boat, whoosh, pull it up in the bushes, pull it up on the bank, help me out of the boat. I get up, I walk up this hill. There's this big campfire going. There's hot water kettles going. The three or four Russians, there were fish hanging in the trees, and 3 or 4 Russians had cut these pine boughs and made little paddles. We're just sitting there relaxed and taking a nap, listening to Russian opera. And, you know, typical American, I'm figuring, well, you know, these guys will be right here shortly. They'll be here quickly. You know, my feet are wet from the time I fell in, and I took my boots off, going to get them dry. They offered me some cheese. They offered me some sallow. They offered me some hot tea. I'm drinking. Heck, man, about 1.5 hours, 2 hours later, by the time the Road Jarrett and other guy got there, man, I was just like a Russian. I was just sitting there half sleeping by the fire, listening to Russian ballet. So they eat a little bit. We get ready, and I figure, well, you know, with all this camp they've got here and all this, you know, we can't be too far to the car. We're 5 miles from the car. Man, did we ever get lost.
Oh, Lord.
We finally get to the car. We finally get home. Neither of us have a capercaillie. The next morning, we're going to go back out. So we go back out capercaillie hunting. And I found a dry spot up under the, and I really liked this. Man, you'd get out there, and we'd build a little fire sometimes. We'd eat cheese and bread, just listen, and then that morning we heard the hens clucking, so we knew they were getting ready to get going, and we heard the going, so Roger grabbed me up. We go make a few stalks, and on that morning it was very frustrating because I got right under this bird. Now understand, it's getting faintly light, so the sky is lit, but inside the dark woods is very black. Everything's black. Everything's backlit. I'm right under this capercaillie, and I can't see him. He's up in a tree. I can't see him. I can't make him out. You know, so he flies, and we go stalk another one. Same deal. I can't see the bird. I mean, it's just he's up there somewhere, but I can't see him. But we come back without birds. After 2 fruitless nights in the woods, Alexi, the head knocking guide, he says, you know, we're going to the White Sea again. You should come with us. And now I'm going capercaillie hunting. Now, understand, Rocky, 2 days in Russia with the light and dark patterns, you just kind of lose your sense of time. It gets to be where after 2 or 3 days in the capercaillie woods, you know, what time is it? 10 o'clock? A.M. or P.M.? You think about it. I don't know. You don't know. It don't matter. Because you're capercaillie hunting. You're getting up and eating and going back to bed. And getting up and eating and going back to bed and getting up and eating and going capercaillie hunting. It's just like you're hibernating, but you're capercaillie hunting. And you just lose sense of time. And after 2 fruitless nights, I had not slept a wink. I was just, my body clock was messed up. I had not slept in days. And Alexi says, hey, we're going to the White Sea. Me and the Maltons, we're going to shoot some other birds. I said, no, I'm going back to capercaillie woods. In fact, Alexi, I'm going to the capercaillie woods, and I'm not coming out without a capercaillie. When we got in there, one of the Maltons and I, Steve, went that morning. And I swear, bird sang. He goes with his guide, and 10 minutes later, he comes back with a capercaillie. I'm like, golly. Steve and his friend Patrick and I became very good friends on this trip. And you know, we were sitting there waiting on another Capricator sing, and it was getting lighter and lighter and lighter. And finally, one sang. And I had a new guide that day. He was a big guide. I cannot remember his name. Big guy. Looked like a big Russian spy. I mean, just, I guarantee you his belt was as long as he was tall. He was just that guy. Wore that old Russian military camo, and we took off, and we got right up on the bird, and he flew, right up on the bird, and he flew. And this guy, instead of taking two steps, taking four steps. Instead of taking that little two-step shuffle, he's taking a four-step ninja shuffle, and I'm right behind him, and I'm huffing and puffing, and we're closing the distance. And he peeks around this tree, and he looks back at me, and he's smiling. And I ease forward around that tree, and when I it's really too late for these birds to be singing, but this bird is really singing, and I can hear him good. And old shooters like us, we can't really hear these birds until we're very close to them, and I can hear them very good. When I peek around the tree, instead of being hidden up in a tree and behind limbs and it being backlit, he's on the top of about a 9-foot Christmas tree. A single beam of light is just lighting him up like the angel on top. I look back at him, and I'm smiling now, too. I know I got this bird, and I shoot, boom, I got him. And when I get back to where Steve was, Steve breaks out a flask. We have a few drinks. We talk. We take pictures. We make the long hike back. Get home. We do vodka shots. That's one thing I learned about Russia is vodka. They don't mix vodka cocktails. I remember one time getting a big cocktail-sized cup out of the cup and asking for vodka. I was thinking like a screwdriver or something. No, she poured it up with vodka. They just take shots over there. Chase it with pickles. Chase it with sallow. Chase it with a bite of fish. Chase it with a bite of fruit. Chase it with another shot of vodka. And because you don't know what time it is, it doesn't matter if it's breakfast or lunch or dinner. It's just meal, and so vodka shots. So we got back, and whatever meal that was, we took vodka shots. And when I went to sleep for 24 hours, I don't think I moved. I had my bird, I had my trophy, and I died. I died. You know, the following year, Steve and Patrick from Malta had contacted me, and they had told me in camp that they wanted to shoot a king eider. And even more than a king eider, they wanted to shoot a wood duck. And I told them, well, my company sells king eider hunts. That's no problem. And they said that of all the bird collections in Malta, that there were king eiders, but there were no king eiders that the owner had shot himself, and they would like to be the first two. And out of all the bird collections in Malta, there were absolutely no wood ducks, and they would like to be the first two. And I said, well, you know, if y'all were to come to King Eider Hunt, that takes place in Alaska. There's no wood ducks there, but we're all buddies. And let me tell you, when we get to the end of this story, you know, it's kind of like a foxhole story with these guys. You get what I'm saying? I said, I'll take your wood duck hunting. So sure enough, the next year or two, they booked a King Eider trip.
You're going to have to find a stopping point in just a second, because we are just about out.
Well, we're going to get to the end of this great story, but listen to this. 2 years later, the Maltons come to Mississippi, and they go king eider hunting. And I'll tell the rest of this story next episode.
Let me just tell you, you're not getting away from here without telling the sauna story.
You want me to tell the final part tonight?
No.
Okay.
No.
Russia was an amazing adventure.
The greatest 20 minutes of your life listening to this, of what happens in Russia. You live this comfortable lifestyle in the United States, and you just go become a part of their culture and the things that they do. Now, I think it is awesome. It's funny. It's eye-opening. It's just great.
Become Russian.
But that's where we're going to stop it, where the Maltons are coming to Alaska, and Alaska to kill the king eider, and Mississippi to kill the wood duck. We'll pick it back up next week there.
All right.
Ramsey, I enjoyed it, man. Great night. A lot of good stuff. Can't wait to get to this part two. I'm telling you, guys, it's good. It is really good stuff. Ramsey, I know you are headed out to Alaska for a few days, so please be careful. We will talk to you again next week.
All right. See you then.
All right. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckStuff.com.